Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Food sustains and food stresses. From food allergies to food scares, a Geek Speak lecture at Black Hills State University dishes up insight into society's relationship with dinner. It's called Panic at the Meat Department, Food Scares as Moral Panics, and joining us now with more is Trenton Ellis. Dr. Ellis, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Why are we so freaked out about what we eat? Let's just start
why
there.
Are we, well, I think there are a variety of reasons why we're freaked out about what we eat. I think there are a lot of people out there trying to influence how we view food and how we perceive food. I think it's a really confusing time sometimes to be an informed consumer. You know, we have all these different choices and all these labels to navigate. And there are all these different companies and other actors out there who are kind of trying to influence the way that we view food. So I think that's probably one reason why we're freaked out about some of the things that we eat.
Now, has it always been this way, or does it just progressively get worse, our anxiety about food and food safety over time?
Well, I think it's been this way for a long time. You can look all the way back to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. Mm-hmm. This was a period of time where food production was shifting from outside of the household to different companies and things that were now producing the food that we ate. We were buying food from other produced by other people. And so there's an issue of trust right there, right? And I think that one thing that Sinclair, his book did was reveal to people that maybe sometimes we have a little bit too much trust, at least back then. But that's, you know, why we have the FDA and things now. So I think people have always worried about the things that they eat, and sometimes rightfully so, as Sinclair's book revealed to us. But I think that with the proliferation of media, modern mass media, and you know, Facebook and some other things, I think that those things can also influence today people's anxieties over food.
Is this basically a first world problem? A problem of abundance that we have, you know, that we can get worried about it? Is this something that you only see in affluent nations?
I don't think so. I don't want to give the perception that it's wrong for people to be concerned about the things that they eat. I think really the purpose of this talk that I'm giving tonight or this evening is just to show how sometimes we react, and our anxieties are sometimes the product just as much of how something is framed for mm-hmm. us versus any actual maybe objective danger of that particular food item. Because there are real concerns with food production. There are times where food has caused illnesses or, you know, and sometimes even unfortunately death. These things are much more less common today than they once were. But I think that my point of this talk is really to show how, you know, sometimes we act again based upon how things are framed to for us. And then our perception of that frame, and sometimes not necessarily any other, the actual objective harm or potential for harm. And I don't think this is, you know, unusual with food. You know, most of our life, we act based on how we perceive reality and not necessarily sometimes the actual quote-unquote facts. And those, how we perceive reality has been based on, you know, how these frames that other people are disseminating to us. So that's kind of the purpose of the talk. It's not really to show that we shouldn't be concerned about food, or sure. I'm not really trying to tell people what to eat. But they have enough people out there, I think, doing that for them. But it's just to explore how our perception of food is shaped by others, including our anxieties.
So give me an idea who benefits from the anxieties then. Who are the actors that would sort of, you know, play on either side of our anxieties about food?
Oh, well, so there's a book by a couple of sociologists, Eric Good and Nachman Ben-Yehuda, about moral panics. And they discuss these moral entrepreneurs and also news media because, you know, news media today are many times competing for eyeballs. So to some extent, sometimes it is the news media who definitely benefits from some of these anxieties. One particular food scare that got me interested in this issue was actually the 2012, and you can't see me doing the air quotes here, but pink slime food scare, not
slime.
My term.
Right.
And this got me interested in these kinds of issues. And what you see during that food scare, you saw ABC News broadcasting that, you know, there was this issue that people should be concerned about, and then they actively solicited people's concerns. So they were using the concerns that they helped to generate then for later coverage. So then they could then cover the concerns that people had as a result of their initial broadcast. Mm. So it was really a good way for them to fill a few news cycles with something salacious or something interesting for people to look at.
And I remember the images of that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you remember the factory images that they shot that then the meat industry said, no, not so fast. That's not exactly. So
yeah,
those visuals stick with you for a long time, too.
Yeah, definitely. The one that sticks out to me the most is there was some kind of almost like a soft serve ice cream type image that was shared over on Facebook through many different avenues, and that image really sticks with me, although and later on we find out that it really had nothing to do with this lean, finely textured beef product that was at the center of this food scare. It was, who knows what it was. Nobody really kind of knows where the origin of that image was or where it came from.
So it taps into that general anxiety that's sort of, you know, historically in context, which is we don't make our own food like we used to. So we do go into the grocery store and get what's off the shelf or drive through somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Politics. Let's talk about the politics of food scares.
Oh, the politics of food scares. Well, do you want to talk about politicians or just the controversies? I think that food scares, one thing that they can do for us, and one thing that this pink slime food scare did was kind of reveal the different fault lines of the politics of food. So where are these different conflicts within food? I think those things become a little bit more salient when we have food scares that kind of reveal those issues, even issues of, you know, what should be considered to be an ingredient or a processing agent, or what's our definition of fresh, right? We've all probably have some perception of fresh in our heads, but maybe our perception is the same as somebody else's.
Yeah. What's our definition of organic?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the organic is definitely something that is politicized, it's standardized. As well by the government. That's a good example.
Are there positive impacts of things you mentioned, Upton Sinclair, in the beginning of our conversation, and that obviously had a huge impact on reform in the industry? Are there times when, you know, it's not moral panic, it's moral outrage?
Oh, absolutely. I think in 1993 there was a food scare, people may remember, over beef that was served at Jack in the Box restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Several folks were sickened. There were several people. There were people who actually died from that food scare, and that scare actually changed practices in terms of how ground beef was prepared in those restaurants. So, you know, I don't want to give the perception that food scares are any kind of figment of our imagination or anything like that. They're definitely real. And there are definitely real concerns sometimes about the process of food preparation and whatnot that, you know, that food scares help to kind of, unfortunately, they're really unfortunate incidents sometimes, but they do have positive impacts on the food system.
Fascinating sort of conversation about sociology. And when you say Jack in the Box, I don't think hardly anybody around here has eaten at one, but I remember that food scare. And I remember, Jack in the Box. I remember all the food I used to eat at Jack in the Box, and then I felt sheepish. So, all right, it's a Geek Speak lecture at Black Hills State, Dr. Trenton Ellis, and it's all about panic at the meat department. We'll talk. He'll talk about moral panic, food scares, sociology, and the intersection with food and what we eat. Trenton Ellis, thanks for having fun with us today. It sounds like a great talk.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. When we come back, Chris Loffrey talks with Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huther. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. Yesterday, we talked about crime statistics in Sioux Falls with Police Chief Matt Burns. This morning, In the Moment producer Chris Loffrey caught up with Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huther. They talked about the city's population increase, the controversy about school choice week in the city, and the recently declared independent. And he asked the recently declared independent about his political future. But first, they talked about the weather.
Let's start with the latest snowstorm. It appears as though the city and your street department staff of Sioux Falls was incredibly prepared for that and did what it needed to do to keep traffic flowing as well as could be done.
Well, I'm one of the biggest cheerleaders of our town, and maybe next to Galen Huber, the biggest cheerleader when it comes to our snow removal team and our road team. And this is what we do, Chris. We really take great pride in removing snow, keeping our streets safe during the summer, but maybe more importantly, keeping our streets safe during the winter. So, yeah, we're ready all the time. And then when the snow comes, we tackle it with vigor. And then we even add snow gates to the mix. And that's really been a good thing for our citizens, too.
With having to move that much snow that we just encountered, it takes, as you know, many, many man-hours and large equipment to make it happen. How does a city of that size accomplish that and accomplish it effectively?
Well, we've got about 80 square miles of roads that we do tackle. But we do it like a science. And whether it be our internal team or whether it be the contractors that we hire, we really take it seriously. We've got the best equipment. We've got a solid team that is well trained, and we work in coordination with the citizens that we serve to make sure that we can do it as efficiently and productively and squeeze as much taxpayer buck out of it that we can. And, I think one of the great things, too, is that most of the work happens when all of us are snuggled in our bed. That's when all these women and these men are really busting their butt on behalf of all the citizens here, as well as the people that come into town to work every day and our visitors, too.
I'm more curious, Your Honor, than anything about my next question. When the snow is loaded onto those trucks of various sizes, where does it go?
It goes to various locations, Chris. But our first step is to actually move the snow. We move it out of the driver's way. But then there are these locations where, you bet, we actually have to pick it up. Some of those main four-lane roads, the Minnesota Avenues, the Louises, the Cliffs. But then also, of course, as you can all imagine, we've got one of the most vibrant downtowns in all of America. And so it's harder to move snow in downtown Sioux Falls. So we actually move it, but then we also lift it and haul it away, too.
It's been recently reported, Mr. Mayor, that the population of Sioux Falls jumped up 3% from last year, bringing in 5,200 more people to your city. Your thoughts on the uptick?
The biggest increase in population we've ever had in our city's history, and doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, this is the place where people want to live. It's the place where they want to work. It's the place where they want to play. And they all want a piece of this pie, and so they are. They're moving here in droves. When you've got the lowest unemployment rate in the country, and CNN just reported that, Chris, we're at 1.9%, a bevy of jobs everywhere, help wanted signs everywhere, people want to be part of it. And then, when you throw on this quality of life that just keeps getting better and better, it didn't surprise me at all when we grew by over 5,000 people. I'm just so proud of it. I'm an old Yankton boy, and so we add a city of Yankton onto the city of Sioux Falls about every 4 years. I mean, can you imagine that? Libraries, parks, police, fire, sewer lines, roads, public safety, you know, quality of life. We're adding a city of Yankton every 4 years.
Your thoughts on the fact of that being the norm, or is this a fluke?
No, I think there is some definite momentum. We've got more confidence and more optimism than we probably ever had before in our city. So yeah, there's just this this spunk, this vigor, this spit, this energy that we have that really is probably fueling it even more. But we have had a pattern of growth here long before I was the mayor. It's just that now we're growing at a faster pace, and Chris, it's happening all over town. It's north, it's south, east, west, and yes, it's in downtown Sioux Falls. I mean, when I was running for mayor, our downtown was hurting. It was really, really struggling. And I mean, I used to I walked up and down every street, every building in downtown Sioux Falls, and I could have lived in some of these buildings. You would have never found me for months when I was running for mayor. And now you can't find an empty storefront anywhere. All these buildings are being utilized, and we are building places to live like crazy, and we can't keep up.
You may have answered my next question in part, but what part or parts of Sioux Falls are you seeing the most growth?
Well, I think that's a very good question, Chris, because in the olden days, it was kind of, and what I mean by that, 7 years ago, it was, the South, the Southeast, the Southwest, that was really where the engine was just really pumping. Not anymore. Now, you know, even the North is just rocking with you know, a new super Walmart, new businesses, more rooftops than you can imagine that are just spread far and wide to the North. So it's all over town, Chris. But maybe one that I'm most excited about, and again, I love the whole town, you know, don't worry about that. But the one area that I think is just so exciting, and anybody listening to the program today, if you haven't seen it lately, you got to stop in, and that's downtown Sioux Falls. I mean, we had four years of record-breaking construction in the city of Sioux Falls. Never happened before. Also, for the very first time, $700 million in construction in 1 year. But of that $700 million, Chris, $50 million in construction activity happened in downtown Sioux Falls. And so I don't know if you can sense that I'm fairly excited about that, but oh my goodness, am I ever. We've got these monster cranes in downtown Sioux Falls right now, and we look a little bit like Berlin, Germany, because if you've been to Berlin lately, they've got such a revitalization of that old country, of that old city, and we've got cranes just like it happening right here in Sioux Falls.
Sticking with the topic of population, Sioux Falls has, as you know, many different ethnic backgrounds that make up its population. So let's talk a little diversity. What do you suppose Sioux Falls offered that drew them to your city?
Well, I think first of all, jobs. I think it's no secret that we've got all kinds of jobs that are available. And we need folks to fill those jobs. And the way that we used to fill them, Chris, was, you know, we'd go to small towns and farms and ranches around this area, and we'd recruit them in. Well, the old days of trying to fill a workforce that way, that's long past, and Governor Dugard will attest that too. So now we reach out to people not only across the Midwest, not only across the United States, but all over the world. And so, yeah, we are embracing diversity in Sioux Falls in a grand, grand way. It's improved our quality of life. It's helped fuel our economic development, and it certainly is impacting the growth of our city, too. And it's just the beginning. Dr. Brian Maher, our superintendent of public schools, for example, he can attest that our schools, the makeup, is so much different right now. And about three or four out of every student, out of every 10 students that are in Sioux Falls Public Schools, they're of diversity. And so if we think we're diverse now, this is only the beginning, and I think we're truly blessed by it.
With a population north of 178,000 now, let's talk infrastructure.
Yeah.
Right now it appears as though it's slightly congested. Is there thoughts on, with the population growing at the pace it is there a fix for that?
I always laugh. And hey, Chris, I'm not laughing at you or at the question, but I love how in Sioux Falls and in South Dakota we talk about congestion. You know, I've lived all over the country and I've traveled all across the world, and so I've seen congestion. To be fair, certainly, you know, around 7:30, 8 in the morning, it's busier. Certainly, around 4:45 to 6 o'clock at night, it's busier. And then, oh, yes, everybody knows around the Empire Mall on a Saturday or Sunday, it's pretty busy too. But we are keeping up with that pace of growth. We are certainly not only building more roads, but we're increasing the capacity of the roads that we have. And then one other thing that I really, really am proud of that we've made these investments, we are investing in technology, Chris, because building roads and making them wider, making them faster, that's just kind of a little, you know, a Band-Aid on what you need to keep up with the congestion challenges. You also need to use technology. You know, make sure that the streetlights are in sync. Make sure that if there is some congestion or a backlog, that we can address that immediately and keep Sioux Falls moving, keep them safe, and also keeping the complaints down. Because when you're the mayor of Sioux Falls, I hear about it at church. I hear about it at the grocery store. I'll hear about it at the event center, Chris. And so if things aren't happening the way that our citizens want, I get an earful. And we respond accordingly.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huether on South Dakota Public Broadcasting's In the Moment. Your Honor, you recently signed a proclamation declaring this week to be School Choice Week in Sioux Falls.
Yes.
Two-part question. What was the reason behind your proclamation, and why do you feel that some Sioux Falls public school leaders were disappointed?
Well, first of all, let me be incredibly clear. Sioux Falls public school leaders weren't disappointed. They had no idea what the context of the question was when they were asked. I've spoken with people like Dr. Brian Maher, and after he found out what the proclamation was all about and the context of the questions, he certainly understood. And again, I'm not going to get into a spitting match in terms of, you know, how the story was written or what the intent was or even what questions were asked of me, because here's the reality, anybody listening. I did not receive one question on school choice, did not receive one question on school funding, did not receive one question on the potential of moving funds from maybe public entities to private entities or anything like that. Chris, I sign proclamations all the time. If they're positive in nature, if they're lifting people up, if they're rallying the cause, guess what? I'm going to support it. My wife Cindy and I, we've got a 20-year record of supporting education at the highest level, not only in Sioux Falls but all across South Dakota, especially public education. So here we were, 20 years of work, 20 years of investment, 20 years of rallying the call. And then all of a sudden, there's a 10-word headline put on the front page. And then I had people questioning whether I am a supporter of public education or education in general. So, Chris, I commend you for asking me that question. It's a tough one. But, you know, when you're in public service, you are going to have to, you know, take on things like this every now and then. But sometimes, Chris, you certainly do have to question why something was done, why something was written, or why something was reported in a certain way. It's now my seventh year as mayor, my seventh year in public service. I wish I could tell you that I'm used to it by now, but I'm not. There's not a public servant in America that's ever going to get used to it, but it's part of the deal. It's part of the journey. And so, you know, I started that morning about as low as I could feel, again, because Cindy and I have put so much work into public education. But by the end of the day, I had so many people lifting me up and rallying me and cheering me on, including Superintendent Brian Maher. So I ended my day at a really, really good high, and that's why I'm back in the fight today. I'm going to fight for private schools. I'm going to fight for public schools. I'm going to fight for the educators, the coaches, the teachers, the administrators, the students, the parents, the fans of education. Because here's one thing I will say. I don't care if it's private schools. I don't care if it's public schools. They're all underfunded, if you ask me.
Let's switch gears and talk about the Premier Center, which is near and dear to your heart because you
Thank
played
you.
Such a big role in getting it built. It appears to me that it's doing just what you had hoped, but many still stand firm that it wasn't needed. Has it done what you had hoped, and do you think it's able to sustain the needs of the community both in and around Sioux Falls?
And I am probably one of its biggest cheerleaders and biggest fans because, yeah, I was in the heat of the battle along with a lot of others. But, Chris, honestly, the naysayers, the critics, and an occasional hater, you don't hear from those people very much anymore when it comes to our new event center. I mean, it's been open 2 years. We are the 88th busiest event center in the world when it comes to touring events. We may be the only publicly owned, publicly managed event center in the country that's actually operating as a profit. With profit, we're operating in the black. We just announced $2.1 million in net revenues that we generated last year. We get you in and out with no parking challenges, with no traffic problems, and we certainly are recognized as the place to play, whether it's Paul McCartney, Elton John, the Eagles, Luke Bryan, PBR. We've got a lot of good things going on. So, no, it's a lot of fun to have it be, you know, doing so well. And probably the thing that I'm really excited about right now, too, Chris, is that we've got, you know, that development that I talked about. It's actually happening out at our new event center, too, with a brand spanking new hotel, restaurant, conference rooms, and, yes, even the South Dakota Golf Hall of Fame is going to go out there, too.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Our guest today is Mayor of Sioux Falls, Mike Huther. Your Honor, you've decided to separate yourself from the Democratic Party and
Yep.
have changed to independent. And I read that you were frustrated with the two-party status quo. Will you elaborate on your thoughts behind your decision there?
Yeah, not only did I separate from the South Dakota Democratic Party, I separated from the parties in general. And I'm putting on my Mike Huther hat now, if you don't mind, Chris. So just for this question, just call me Mike. Because Mike Huther made a very, very conscious decision that he's had enough. I'm sick and tired of the polarization that the two-party system has created. It's the extremes that are controlling, you know, our country's governance right now. One thing I'm very, very clear of, and I'm going to probably take some heat on South Dakota Public Radio right now, but hey, if anybody wants to call me a moderate, I love it. I'll wear it as a badge of honor because I think moderates, we know how to compromise. We know how to collaborate. We know how to get crap done. And, you know, you find the middle. You fight like cats and dogs. You know, you fight for your cause. You fight for what you think is right. But ultimately, if you're going to get something done in your home or in your church or in business or, yeah, even in government, dang it, you find the middle. And I think that being independent, you know, being able to choose what you want to do in terms of who you want to vote for, what you think the right policy is, or what you think the right investment is in terms of our taxpayer dollar, I think being independent is the right thing to do. And I think there's a real movement out there right now. And it's not just the millennials that are part of this independent movement. I'll tell you, Chris and listeners out there, I got a lot of kudos, you know, with the way that we ran the ice storm. I got a lot of kudos, yes, on things like the event center. But, oh, my goodness, this reaction to me being independent and saying I'm not going to take it anymore, it's got to be up there in the top three in terms of people cheering me on. And Chris, you might as well ask, or I'll beat you to it. You know, what's been the reaction from maybe some Democrats out there? And folks, you've heard me now probably long enough. You know me well enough by now. I'm just going to tell you what I know, and I'm not going to beat around the bush. I've received 3 negative notes since I've made that announcement. 3. One was over Facebook message, and I responded to that person, and he now understands. Another one was through an email that I got here at work. I got back to that person, and now he understands. And then there was one other, and it was written to me anonymously. And I wish that I had the chance to get to that person too, but he or she didn't give me their name or their address or their phone. So that person's still mad at me.
Finally, once you've completed your mayoral duties to the city of Sioux Falls, have you given any thought as to what you see yourself doing in the future, both politically and not politically?
Chris, I think about it all the time. I've been thinking about it since I was in the sixth grade. My wife was just here. Chris was doing this interview, and I just kissed her. I don't know if you got that on the radio or not. But Cindy and I have been talking about this with Kylie ever since we've known each other. So, yeah, Chris, I think about it all the time. I mean, I think that South Dakota people, they know how much I love this public service gig. So I think about it all the time. But right now, I was elected and still am elected to serve the people of Sioux Falls, and I'm busting my butt to do it at the highest level that I can. But yeah, it's a reality that I've only got 16 more months to serve, and I want to do something with the day that God gives me. But right now, and I'm not pulling any punches. Cindy and I haven't decided. We've not decided. I mean, and yeah, it's killing me a little bit inside because I don't know a good answer for you right now, Chris. We'll figure it out, and when we do, it'll be full guns a-blazing. I think that's one thing that also that people know about me is that when I jump into something, no one, and I mean no one, is going to work harder to ensure that we, win and that we meet the results. And I've tried to do that for the citizens of Sioux Falls, and I'll keep doing that, whether it's for the state of South Dakota or whether it's for the United States of America, or maybe it's rather just for Mike Huther and my family and my friends, because that's another option, is just to going back to being Mike Huther, you know, dad, husband, and friend, and maybe, and now grandpa to baby George.
Your Honor, Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huther, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Chris, I've loved it. And again, thanks for having the guts and the willingness to engage this Huther guy. I love it. And anytime you want to chat, you've got an open dialogue to me.
That's SDPB's Chris Loffrey talking with Sioux Falls Mayor Mike Huther. After the break, counting tribal citizens in South Dakota, the U.S. Census Bureau pilots a new program in Standing Rock. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Deirdre Delpiaz Bishop is with the U.S. Census Bureau. She's chief of geography. She was at the garage this morning in Rapid City for the morning fill-up. That's always sponsored by the NUMAD Group, and the Bush Foundation supports it as well. She is now in our studios at Rapid City for a conversation. Deirdre Delpiaz Bishop, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you. Thank you for having me this morning.
So give me an idea of what brings you to South Dakota, because there's a pilot program I think maybe we could start talking about here.
Sure. A few things. I was fortunate enough to meet the gentleman who's responsible for the Morning Fill-Up series and graciously invited me to come out to South Dakota. It was the perfect time to do so because we're preparing for the 2020 census. We've conducted several tests over the past few years. We've outlined the design of the 2020 census, which is going to be much different from 2010. And I'm happy to share information about those tests with you today.
Excellent. Let's get started. What has changed?
Most exciting. We've been looking at four areas. We call those areas our innovation areas. Those were the primary cost drivers of the 2010 census, and we heard loud and clear after the 2010 census we needed to find a way to reduce the escalating costs of a census. And so we looked at the way we build the Census Bureau's address list, and we changed it. We call that re-engineering address canvassing. We looked at the way that we encourage people to self-respond and figured out new ways to optimize self-response. We looked at ways we could use information that people have already provided to the government when they don't respond to the census. And finally, our fourth innovation area, we looked at ways we could re-engineer our field operations. How do we go out and knock on people's doors? In the past, we used paper, we used pencils. This decade, we're going to use technology, smartphones and tablets.
So how much has technology changed in the 10 years? It's going to be an asset to you going forward.
Mm-hmm. Technology is playing a significant difference in the way we're doing business at the Census Bureau. First and foremost, in terms of the way we build our address list, in 2009, we hired 150,000 people to walk around every block in the nation to validate our address list. This was an enormous task. As we look to 2020, we're doing most of the work in the office. We're comparing different vintages of satellite images. Imagery from 2009 compared to imagery of today, and detecting change right there in the office looking at computer monitors. This is going to enable us to visit only 25% of the addresses on the ground, validate the other 75% in the office.
I'm not quite making that connection. So how does a satellite image replace going to someone's door and talking to them?
Mm-hmm. The satellite imagery is a tool to help us build our address list and our maps.
Okay.
It doesn't involve talking to people. And that's important because we need to build the foundation to make the census successful. We use our address list to help invite people to participate in the census. Mm. We use our address list and our maps to send our enumerators to knock on the doors when those people don't respond.
So will people be responding using the current technology that they have, or do you start out sort of the old-fashioned way?
Mm-hmm. We are going to encourage people as much as possible to respond using the internet. This is the first census in which we'll use the internet for what we call self-responding to the Census Bureau. Mm-hmm. Most of the population, our testing has shown, will respond using the internet, but some people, specifically the elderly we're finding, and also those without internet access, would like to respond using a different mode. And so we're going to provide an option to respond over the telephone. We'll open up census questionnaire assistance centers across the nation. And if they don't want to respond on the telephone, they're still going to be able to respond the old-fashioned way, using pen and paper on a census questionnaire.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about people doing their genealogy, and when you get that census list from the 1920s and sort of see the handwriting and the names of people, how do people access the census today?
Mm-hmm. Today, we protect all of our information by Title 13 of the U.S. Code. This means we protect the information that each individual in each housing unit has provided to us. We build our statistics and we release them at the census block level, which in most instances is the size of a city block. Mm. It's not until 72 years later that we release data about individuals, and that's the type of information you can access via Ancestry.com and through our National Archive Center.
Sure. So let's talk about reservation counts and the pilot program that affects South Dakotans.
Mm-hmm. We are working very closely with the tribes across the nation to determine how we best can build our address list and then enumerate people living on the reservation. We had planned in 2017 to conduct not only a national test of 80,000 housing units, in which we would send out a questionnaire and ask about tribal enrollment. We also plan to do a test in Puerto Rico and on two tribal reservations, one of which was Standing Rock. We met with Standing Rock several times. They were very gracious, agreed to participate, be part of our test. But unfortunately, due to funding limitations in fiscal year 17, we had to cancel the two tribal reservation sites and our Puerto Rico site. We will still move forward with the national sample of 80,000 housing units. That questionnaire will include a question we're testing about collecting tribal enrollment information.
Why is that significant?
We heard after the last census that there may be an interest from the tribes to know how many people were actually enrolled as compared to the number of people living on the reservation. And so we thought it would be worth a try after talking with our stakeholders to see how people responded to that question on the actual census questionnaire.
So this morning at the garage, you gave your presentation. What kind of questions were people asking you? Because they don't have access to someone from the census very often.
I think people were very interested in the way we build our address list. I like to talk about the address list as the foundation for the census, like building a house. You want to make sure that you have a good foundation before you put the second floor, the third floor, the shingles on. It's the same at the Census Bureau. We want to make sure that we have a very strong address list and maps to make sure we send an invitation to every housing unit, and that when those people respond to the census, we tabulate their information in the right geographic location. There are a number of ways that local governments, counties, states can participate and help build our address list. Coming up is the local update of census addresses, and I would strongly encourage every highest elected official to participate in this important program. It's your chance to review the Census Bureau's address list following our confidentiality procedures and tell us if we have it right.
How do you ensure accuracy? What are the challenges to that?
Accuracy is very important to the Census Bureau. We pride ourselves on being one of the premier statistical organizations in the world. We do our best when we build our address list to validate our information using a number of different sources. One example is the United States Postal Service. They share their address list with us, and every year we add over 1 million new addresses using information from the Postal Service. We also compare our address information to the addresses that are provided by state, county, and local governments. That helps us ensure quality. From a data perspective, we conduct a number of tests to find out how we're asking the questions, if that's effective, and if it's generating the best response from our respondents. We do these tests over the course of the decade to make sure that by the time we hit the decennial census, we're getting it right.
If you're just tuning in, Deirdre Del Piaz Bishop is the U.S. Census Bureau Chief of Geography, and I'm wondering how you got into statistics in the first place. When I'm thinking back to when you were in elementary school or high school, how did you end up on this path?
I thought I was going to be an accountant when I went to college. Yeah. And after 3 years of having accounting as my major and urban studies as my minor, I figured out that urban studies was really my preference. I think I was suited for that. My father was an architect. My mother was an art teacher. I had been exposed to different cities throughout my life, and it really made a lot more sense. I'm thrilled I did that because I started working for a regional planning board in upstate New York, where I learned about the value of census data and what a difference that can make to the communities, especially when they engage with us. And that took me to the Census Bureau. Huh. I just celebrated my 21st anniversary this month.
So let's talk about what happens with that information and how it can help a community that maybe people don't understand.
Mm-hmm. First and foremost, we take the census. Our mission is mandated by the U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 says that we must conduct a decennial census every 10 years for the purposes of reapportioning our representation in Congress. That's the most important reason we conduct the census. But the data is also used to help with the redistricting of the congressional and the state legislative district boundaries, as well as voting district boundaries and school district boundaries. That census data is used to do that, the drawing of those lines. It's also used to allocate over $400 billion in federal funds every single year for the purposes of improving education, the school systems, improving the roads, the transportation networks, services that are provided to the local communities.
What's a successful census for your organization? When do you feel good about how the work has gone?
Mm-hmm. A successful census will be when every single person in the United States responds to that census. We're going to try to count everyone once, only once, in the right place to ensure an accurate count for our country.
Is that possible?
I think it is possible.
Yeah?
I think the movement, starting early, starting now, communicating often, with our population is important, and I think if people begin to understand how much the census means, they'll be willing to respond to the census.
And how does your organization change and grow and shift and hire extra people and then contract again? Or are you staffed fully every year?
No, the census is like a wave. Oh. In the years ending 1 and 2, there are hundreds of people working at the Census Bureau in the dedicated to the decennial census. But in the years ending 8, 9, and 0, there are hundreds of thousands of people working on the decennial census.
That is a huge human resources challenge, is it not?
It is. The census is actually the largest peacetime mobilization that's conducted by the United States government.
Huh. How much does your job change as a presidential administration changes? Does that affect you at all?
Well, the census is truly nonpartisan. Yeah. We have a mission. It's embedded in the U.S. Constitution, and we're going to move forward with our plans. We have a new design for 2020. We're proud of the design. We believe we can make that design work. We need the funding. We need the commitment from Congress in order to make that happen.
What else do you need? You need public to understand the importance of it. You need support from congressional leaders. What else do people need to understand about how the Census Bureau works that maybe they don't?
I think it's really important to know that you can make a difference by engaging with the Census Bureau. Local government officials have the opportunity to influence how well we conduct the census, not only by helping us build our foundation, the address list, and the maps, but by engaging with their communities and telling people how important it is to participate in the census. It's the same is true for community leaders, the pastors, the rabbis, the people who are directly touching the people of the community. If we can get them to help us, it will go a long way.
Deirdre Delpiaz Bishop is U.S. Census Bureau Chief of Geography. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.